In 2011, the San Francisco Symphony celebrates its 100th season. Since 1925, the orchestra has been making recordings. I'm Scott Fogelsong, a contributing writer and pre-concert lecturer here at the Symphony. For some years now, I've been exploring the Symphony's long and distinguished history and recorded sound, a vast treasure of music preserved in commercial recordings, in radio broadcasts, and from the Symphony's own archives. I invite you to join me in these podcasts as I share some of my favorite moments drawn from 85 years of great recordings by the musicians of the San Francisco Symphony. On this special extra-length podcast, the Pierre Monta era at the San Francisco Symphony. Monta's tenure at the helm of the symphony lasted for 17 years, from 1935 to 1952. But his recorded legacy with the symphony was even longer. It began in 1941 and extended all the way to 1960. When Pierre Monta arrived to assume the leadership of the San Francisco Symphony in 1935, he was charged with the task of resurrecting an orchestra that had suffered through a near-death experience just the year before. The Great Depression, combined with music director Isai Dobrovain's indifference, had led to the orchestra's losing its way after Alfred Hertz's departure in 1930. The orchestra made no commercial recordings between 1929 and 1941, nor have any transcription discs of the Standard Hour broadcasts from the 1930s survived, if indeed any were made at all. Thus, the sound of the San Francisco Symphony during the 1930s will remain mostly a mystery. But we have one document that offers a clue, a radio broadcast from 1935 called Mobilization for Human Needs that featured the San Francisco Opera Orchestra under Gaetano Merola. Since the opera orchestra was staffed mostly by symphony players, this broadcast gives us an idea of the symphony's sound as of Monta's arrival. In this performance of the overture to Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, you can hear that the orchestra was still fundamentally Hertz's, noted by a cushioned and homogeneous tone. The broadcast was likely unrehearsed, however, which accounts for the flute player's miscounting in the second phrase and his subsequent scramble to get back on track. In contrast to the 1930s, the next decade and more, from 1941 through Monta's final 1952 season, is very well documented in sound. The symphony signed a recording contract with RCA Victor, continuing the long series of records begun under Alfred Hertz in the 1920s. And luckily, almost 12 years' worth of transcription discs from the Sunday night Standard Hour broadcasts have survived. From those, we have been able to hear not only the San Francisco Symphony, but also the Los Angeles Philharmonic and the San Francisco Opera as they were during and after the war years. Those Sunday night broadcasts were a West Coast institution, as announcer John Grover started the festivities by saying,
"This hour is yours, the Standard Hour."
That lush melody was written by the symphony's own Julius Hoag.
Tonight, we greet you from the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco, from the stage of which the Standard Oil Company of California is presenting the Standard Hour. Pierre Monteux is conducting the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra.
Initially, the RCA recordings were sonically compromised due to the necessity of sending the audio through telephone lines down to the RCA studios in Los Angeles. They're plagued by a certain murkiness, even with RCA's attempt to enliven the sound with a boost in the bass range. Here's Maurice Ravel's La Valse from 1941. We can hear how much clearer the standard hour broadcast recordings are. Those didn't have to go through the phone lines, such as this broadcast of Rimsky-Korsakov's Christmas Eve Suite. Eventually, RCA started using tape masters and didn't need the phone lines. The later Montreux San Francisco recordings are dramatically better sonically than their predecessors. Consider this Beethoven Fourth Symphony from 1952. Even better, we have a 1960 stereo recording of Montreux conducting the symphony as a guest conductor in works by Richard Strauss and Wagner. It was made in the California Hall at 625 Polk Street, a striking neo-baroque building that's now part of the California Culinary Academy. Here's a bit of Strauss's Death and Transfiguration from that recording. We can hear certain characteristics of Montreux's San Francisco Symphony that remain quite constant throughout his tenure. First and foremost was the orchestra's unique sound. There was no mistaking the San Francisco Symphony for any other orchestra. In an era in which orchestras were becoming increasingly similar, that individuality was quite refreshing. In Weber's Overture to Euryanthe, note this almost French, wind-propelled character, very much unlike the string-dominated sound of the Hertz era. Montreux's symphony was not homogeneous. Instead, the orchestra's sections were clearly delineated. You never had any problem hearing the winds within the body of strings. Those pungent winds were one of the symphony's most noticeable characteristics, as in here with Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet. Thank you. You may have noticed a certain almost breathlessly ardent aspect to the famous love theme in that Tchaikovsky. That heady exuberance was part and parcel of Monteux's music making, not just with the San Francisco Symphony, but throughout his career. But here, with his own orchestra, he could really indulge that brio to its fullest. Consider his utterly unbuttoned approach to Franck's ballet Psyche. There's something almost adolescent about Monteux's symphony. It wasn't a grandly cushioned orchestra, but a greyhound-lean ensemble with a springy vitality. The players were accustomed to playing opera and ballet in addition to orchestral works, and that energetic theatricality is often on display. Try this William Tell Overture from March 1952. Monteux himself was partial to breathtakingly fast tempi, and the orchestra was always ready and willing to follow him no matter how precipitous it all seemed. This Beethoven Fifth from 1947 must be the zippiest ever recorded, but it's never metronomic, nor does it seem fast just for the sake of being fast. It's just exhilarating. Several years ago, I was giving a pre-concert lecture at the Symphony on Berlioz, and I used Monteux's recording of the Roman Carnival Overture as one of my examples. After the lecture, several of the orchestra players rushed over to me backstage and asked, "What was that orchestra I heard? That's the fastest I've ever heard that piece." Well, it is hair-raising indeed. Here's Monteux zooming through the end of the Roman Carnival Overture. Monteux Monto was blessed in having Norm Blender as his concertmaster. Blender was originally appointed by Isai Dobrovain, but happily for us, he did not take his services elsewhere when the symphony canceled the 1934-35 season. Blender's solos still stand as highlights in the symphony's long recorded history. Consider his fascinating performances in the iconic 1942 recording of Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, an album likely to be found near record players all over America. On November 20, 1949, principal oboist Merrill Remington supported Blender as he performed the second movement of the Brahms Violin Concerto live for a standard hour broadcast. Remington's clear, pungent oboe tone was one of the signature sounds of Monto's symphony, while Blender's grasp of the movement's long line is absolutely outstanding. Blender wasn't the only outstanding first chair player. There were a lot of superb musicians sitting in those orchestra seats. Consider this chamber-like group in the opening of Beethoven's Prometheus Overture in a live broadcast from 1944. Harp, Virginia Morgan. Flute. 18-year-old Paul Renzi. Bassoon, Ernst Kubitschek. Thank you. Clarinet, Rudolf Schmidt. Cello, Lender's younger brother, Boris. But Monta had to deal with some problems as well. Union rules made it all but impossible for him to hire outside the Bay Area. And while that meant a healthy talent pool, Monta was a bit restricted compared to the big East Coast orchestras. Monta's San Francisco Symphony was not a model of orchestral rectitude or technical perfection. Intonation could become subpar, the ensemble could fall apart, and the strings were sometimes downright scrappy. The standard hour performances were always live, so almost anything could happen, and it did. These excerpts from Wagner's Die Walküre display one of those intonation disagreements that happened sometimes between brass and woodwind sections. Nor was Monteux all that concerned about goofs, as long as the musical message got across. The RCA recording of Ravel's La Valse is a case in point. Principal trumpet Benjamin Klatzen got into an argument with Monteux about wages for the recording session, so Monteux gave the solo to assistant principal Charles Bubb. Bubb was normally an absolutely reliable player, but he had a lot of trouble with one particular passage, and a big goof has been immortalized on the recording. It is said that Monteux kidded Bubb that everybody would think that Klatzen made the goof and not him. Sometime later, they were rehearsing La Valse for a concert. This time, Klatzen was playing, and he bungled the same passage. Monteux quipped, "Oh, you want to sound just like the record." Those aforementioned scrappy strings are on display in Haydn's Symphony No. 88 in G Major, broadcast on January 21st, 1945. Thank you. Well, maybe all that energy was a bit too much sometimes. But these issues are really small potatoes. The most important thing to remember about Malta's San Francisco Symphony is its elan and its vitality, and not its occasional lapses. RCA generally assigned Malta and the Symphony to repertory a bit off the beaten path. The big ticket items were usually given to RCA's East Coast groups, like Boston, Philadelphia, or Toscanini's NBC Symphony. But Malta did record some major repertory items in San Francisco, including Beethoven's Symphonies 2, 4, and 8, the Schumann 4th, and the Brahms 2nd. That Brahms did so well on the market that the original 78 RPM masters wore out and could not be used for further pressings, so the orchestra re-recorded the work in 1951. However, many consider the 1945 version to be the better performance, both musically and sonically. So, here's a bit of it. Some of the Malta recordings had only a limited release and have never been made available since, sadly enough. His superb rendition of Richard Strauss's Heldenleben had to wait almost 40 years before it was available to the general public. Well, here's a bit of that. Malta was particularly associated with two composers, Stravinsky and Berlioz. Here's a selection from his 1951 RCA recording of the Symphonie Fantastique with its sinus-clearing mass chimes. Malta conducted Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring on that legendary night of its first performance. Any Malta performance of Le Sacre carries a special weight of authenticity, as does his 1945 RCA recording of the work here in San Francisco. Thank you. Monta was quite assiduous about promoting the music of local composers such as Roger Sessions, Ernest Bloch, and Dario Miod, among others. Consider this 1947 performance of UC Berkeley professor William Denny's Preludium for Orchestra. Throughout the Monta era, the greatest stars of the day came to San Francisco to solo with the symphony. Artur Rubinstein graced us with the Chopin Second Piano Concerto, here captured on a standard hour broadcast of May 18, 1947. Or the legendary Misha Elman, then in his mid-50s and in superb form, playing the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto on February 16, 1947. The list of soloists is long, and obviously I can't include examples of more than a few on this podcast. But those soloists included Igor Stravinsky, Marian Anderson, Joseph Sigeti, Jacques Thibaud, Helen Traubel, Maggie Tate, Yehudi Menuhin, and many more. The symphony also had guest conductors from time to time, although the practice was less frequent in those days than now. Still, the roster includes Igor Stravinsky, Maurice Abravanel, William Steinberg, Arthur Fiedler, and Ephraim Kurtz, among others. One audience favorite was Meredith Wilson, composer of several San Francisco-based symphonic works and future author of The Music Man and The Unsinkable Molly Brown. Wilson was on the podium for the Standard Hour's 1,000th broadcast. His program for that evening focused mostly on lighter fare, although it included a movement from Beethoven's Eroica, and featured Sigmund Romberg's drinking song, belted out by an enthusiastic male chorus.
Drink, 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 to eyes that are bright, the stars and the shining of me. Drink, 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 to lips that are red, and sweet as the fruit on the
Throughout his San Francisco tenure, Pierre Monteux was approachable and affable. Mrs. Max C. Sloss hosted a radio program on KNBC called Know Your Symphony. At the end of the 1948 season, Hetty sat down with Pierre Monteux for a broadcast chat. Her final words and Monteux's response sum up everything to me that was special about the symphony's beloved maître.
When love and skill work together, you always have masterpieces. And with you, it is love and skill working together, and you always produce masterpieces.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Sloss. If we did not have the microphone between us, you could see me blushing. Thank you.
The Monteux era was filled with wonderful music making from a unique American orchestra. That era would be followed by a difficult decade, but one that had its share of musical achievements, as we shall find out on the next podcast.